Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined by my friend and colleague, Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Welcome to High Summer.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely high summer because my kids are in my office while we're recording this.
Yes. The very definition of high summer. Eating candy.
Eating candy and doing making
gifted by my wife.
Making
of
messes.
You'd have to carry that burden as a parent.
Exactly.
So, we've been away for a bit. Our last podcast that we released was kind of the simulcast that we did with Pat on the last poll. And to say the least, a lot has happened since then. There's no way to cover it all today. We're going to focus on the special session agenda,
right. The
politics around that. Obviously, all kinds of other things going on. The July 4th floods could be a topic in and of themselves that will get discussed in the context of the special session. We've had some personal news from Senator and Attorney General Paxton, which, while interesting in a panel I was on yesterday, there was kind of a consensus that it really wasn't going to affect the Attorney General very much.
Yeah.
At least among my other panelists. I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced.
I was just thinking about a bunch of old people going, marriage is tough.
Yeah. Well, except that it wasn't a bunch of old guys.
No.
It was actually a younger version
that's
of that
true.
Panel.
There was
James bought a gun.
There's one younger
version. The guy's been in the business a while. He's a vet. He's a pro. But, compared to me, he's like 12.
That's right. Exactly.
So, a lot of things going on. But let's start. So we'll start with the obvious. As everybody here knows, Governor Abbott announced a special session of the Texas legislature that will meet on the 21st. He announced the specific agenda, and we'll get into this timing. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. He telegraphed that there was going to be a special session and then came out with the initial agenda right at the end of the signing session when he very controversially, and we talked about this last week somewhat in the Pat simulcast, when he vetoed the legislation strongly and very vocally favored by Dan Patrick on THC products. But that initial agenda has been, it's been one of the things that's commented on, and then we're going to deconstruct it some, is that it's another big one.
Right.
Right. It's a long agenda, which is kind of a, I think in retrospect, we'll probably look at this and see it as a common Greg Abbott play.
It's a good use of the tools at his disposal,
right.
I think, turns out.
Now, in the interim, we've seen this terrible flooding in the Hill Country on July 4th. I've got it in my kind of shorthand notes to myself, altered the terrain of the special session, made an already complex session more complicated.
Right.
But I think a lot of what we were sorting out as we've talked about it since then and talking about before we came on air is, exactly how that complicates things. There's no lack of things to point to. Settling on what that dynamic actually means, I think, is going to be a matter of some discussion today.
No, it's funny. I mean, as we sit here and as you bring it up again, we were talking about this just a little bit ago, sort of in the lead up to this and sort of thinking about the way that it complicates it. And then, look, this is a podcast about politics.
Yeah.
So just to sort of set that out, setting aside the particulars of the tragedies and everything that went on out there. And I mean, I've been out to Kerrville, we've all been around, and I think a lot of people don't appreciate it. Texas is big. It's not that big kind of thing,
Yeah.
But nonetheless, when just looking at the politics, it's sort of a first thing, this complicates. And then you think, or does it? Because it sort of seems like, as we've kind of been talking about, it seems like it's actually probably going to provide, I'll say the leadership with a little bit more cover on some of this other stuff that maybe might be a little bit more, touchy.
Well, I mean, I just think it's going to, we'll get to it. It's going to scramble priorities in a way
right.
that it, I it, don't, you know, I think how that unfolds is a little unclear. And part of that is because, you know, the coverage and the discussion is still kind of going on.
Yeah.
And this is going to re-raise all that. There are going to be field hearings of the select committee that's been put together in both houses.
Yeah. And I mean,
you know, well, there's going to be a hearing in Austin fairly soon, I think middle of next week. And then there's going to be a field hearing in Kerrville. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, what it comes down to is, I think, you know, I mean, it's sort of a weird thing, but the legislature is, you know, keyed to respond to this. I mean, there have been bills that have been filed in the past, if you read the coverage of this, that would have, you know, done some things that might have helped, you know, in this sort of scenario. They can go back to that kind of stuff. So it's not like, you know, they're sort of wild. Like, there's no, like, they're starting from scratch on any of this stuff. They have ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, look, if you approach it, you know, from the sterile, you know, view of like a policy problem.
Yeah.
You know, they're not getting at this from scratch, but, and we'll get into this, but the politics hovering over this, you know, when you've got both President Trump and Governor Abbott calling people losers for trying to say, hey, was there any responsibility here? Or, well, you know, should we probe what might have gone wrong? Well, and
I mean,
there's not going to be a whole lot of desire to do that.
Yeah. And we're not, and I mean, there's not even a lot of desire to do that here at this moment right now, but I just want to hone in on one thing for a second about it, which I think is why there's a certain amount of flexibility. And we've talked about this, is that, like, you know, for people looking to say, well, it, you know, it was this or it was that. I mean, as someone who's here, it's sort of hard enough to say, like, yeah, I mean, you know, if you really want to point at something, people are trying to do this. There's sort of just an overall cultural element to it. And when I say cultural, that's a big word, but just in the sense of, like, you know, I've been, again, I was up in Kerrville recently, actually, this past semester.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one of the things, you know, when we were doing is the Hill Country Economic Summit, and somebody came up from the city and they were sort of talking about Kerrville, and they're saying, you can go on our website and you can look at every line in the budget. And if you want to submit your own budget, that, you know, you can go and make all these adjustments. And I'm just tell that to say, like, it really, when people say, like, hey, this is a fiscally conservative place, hey, the idea, like, they bristled at the cost of this stuff. It's like, that is very real.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, and so that's just to say that there's no, like, oh, if only, you know, everybody had just done this one thing, then everything, it's like, it doesn't work that way. But to me, what that means is that there's also a lot of flexibility in terms of what the response is going to look like, given what are the constraints that existed. Because honestly, you can do just about anything that might make people feel better about the future with this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. But I also think that there's a, you know, there's a interesting dynamic here. And we saw this a little bit, but in a less diffuse way,
mm-hmm.
After Winter Storm Uri and the blackouts and deaths that came after that. And I think what we're seeing with the flooding and the issue of response and, you know, who asked for money when, who said no, who decided it was too much, who just, you know, and there's been a lot of coverage and a lot of unpacking of that. There was a, you know, a fairly decent New York Times podcast, one of the reporters on the ground that was talking about this and had talked to a lot of the local officials and had kind of done some pretty good spade work on this and was, I think, trying to be fair, you know, and there was kind of a sense of, you know, there were a lot of people that made decisions at times that you could say contributed, you know, may not have prevented this, but probably prevented the implementation of things that might have made it a little less severe, might have saved some lives. You know, but you're in a position where when it's diffuse like that, and it's diffuse among all three, you know, involving, you know, all three levels of the federal structure.
Right.
You know, there's some national money that was floating around here and, you know, who was making decisions about that. There's the parallel issue of the Weather Service and DOGE and the cuts and all that. And then there's this money that was going from the federal government through the state that they were administering to the localities and who was making decisions about that and who got more, you know, all of this. And the conclusion there, you know, the line that came out is, you know, the problem is, you know, when, you know, there's kind of no easy person to blame and there's a lot of actors involved, then no one's responsible.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the dynamic I'm kind of feeling right now.
Yeah.
With this, you know, the turn in the tone of politics where, you know, Greg Abbott feels free to call, you know, a reporter a loser for asking a question about
this is pretty wild.
What might happen, right? And so
it's pretty wild, but sensible. I mean, like, it's both wild and it totally fits the context you laid out there, but also the current political dynamic right now
that's exactly right. And so I think that's why it's, you know, I feel like there's a part of me that wants to go, this will just go into the process and they'll just kind of address it with a similar diffuse approach that we've seen them address a lot of these problems, yeah. do some things in the short run that demonstrate action, do some things that are geared more towards the middle and longer run, studies will be held,
yeah.
you know, spend some money. And I guess, you know, now we're just talking about it. So, yeah. but, you know, we were talking when we started, though, that, you know, before we came on air, you know, what is the, you know, we're seeing different proximate comparisons. I've already implicitly right. made the proximate comparison with the storm,
right.
with Winter Storm Uri. The other is gun violence, and in particular, the Uvalde shootings,
totally.
Which really mobilized the legislature. But in both of those cases, our polling showed that though one might argue that more or less good faith efforts were made, I would an asterisk on the gun stuff for the Uvalde shootings.
Yeah, it's but, a little tricky given the what you know, happened.
And that, yeah, and that had a, but more or less, you could say, look, you know, action was taken, a response was made.
Yeah.
You know, think, you know, the legislature did stuff and the public was has been kind of meh about it. I mean, the overall pattern, particularly on grid reliability, which affected the most people of all three of these examples, has been, yeah, I'm not that confident that what they did is going to really address the situation.
Well, same thing with school safety. I mean, honestly, right. whenever we ask questions about sort of legislative priorities yeah. around education, school safety still tops the list. When we ask specifically, do you think the legislature has done something to reduce the chances of school violence? You know, again, the fences are out. If you go by schools, you can see the new fences, but people said no. I mean, there was not a lot of confidence there either. And so, I mean, you know,
and my only point about that is not that anybody's responsible or they're going to do it or they're not going to do it, but is that it's very, it's difficult to kind of figure out when you drop this into this, when you drop these issues into this agenda yeah. that's already existing that we're going to talk about in a second, like how does all of that interact, particularly with the politics of redistricting?
And how much should we expect it to?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the piece I would just throw out there is I think, you know, when you layer all that stuff in, I think there's an ongoing discussion that we've had in this podcast. Well, and it's a question I think that's sort of floating around out there, which is, you know, is there a point at which complete Republican control of statewide leadership and all houses of government and everything accrues some kind of responsibility to at least the accumulation of these things that can be seen as, you know, if you just want to pile it into like one big bucket, ineffective governance, you
right.
know, whether that's the inability to protect kids in the schools. I'll just say this way, like, you know, I mean, like you could do this real quick and say, like, you know, if you're a Democrat right now and you want to run an ad, you could say, you know, I wish Texas were a place where when it rained and snowed, people didn't die.
Yeah.
And that kind of just sums up the idea here that, like, you know, there's just a little bit too much of this going on. And you kind of go back even to like Hurricane Harvey. You
yeah.
think about sort of how and when the city was or was not evacuated and things like that. And so these things are sitting there. But the problem is that, like, for most, I mean, the problem for Democrats here is that for most people, you know, if you believe the government's being mismanaged, you're probably not voting for Republicans anyway.
Yeah.
And honestly, there's gonna be a very small share of people who otherwise are really happy with what's going on, but don't really think that, like, on some of these kind of core fundamental stuff that they're doing a great job. But at the same time, if they're happy with what's going on in an ideological sense otherwise, which is kind of what we're pointing to with its other stuff, you know, I mean, are you really going to go around and vote for Democrats if you get redistricting,
yeah,
if you get property
huge,
tax cuts?
And so you may tell, you know, when you're asked on a poll,
right,
you know, you have faith that they've done a good job, you're going to say no, but that's not going to—
That's not the operative consideration
right,
here.
That, well, it's, you know, the follow-up on that is not—
yeah, right.
You know, and so—
So now
you know,
right.
Yeah, I'm voting for—
Well, and I think this goes back to the fact that, like, a lot of the—
Whatever Democrat.
Right, and so that, you know, there is going to be some movement in some places, and we've already kind of talked about it a little bit on this podcast, and we might see some more of that. But, you know, for most Republican voters who are a majority of the voters in the state, there's lots that they can look to from this session and say, that's a good job. And we talked about this. There's a lot of things that they can hang their hats on in terms of the voucher bill, in terms of property tax reduction, in terms of, you know, increasing
right.
funding to public education, putting money into water, all that stuff before you even get to this. And this is like a different kind of list.
Except
now.
That, and yet, now, if the— If the, you know, the history of the 89th legislature had already been written
mm-hmm.
without it, you know, and it had all been written in the regular session, it would look a lot, I think it's, you know, that's different than now having to write with all this here. And I take your point that,
no, I mean,
you know, we were going to talk about attention to the legislature and all this, but, you know, I still kind of feel like this is not anything that most anybody really wanted.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, one of the things that's really shocking sitting here right now with a special session coming up next week is the fact that, you know, I don't know, I'm not good with time, but let's say 4 to 8 weeks ago, I don't think you could find a person who thought that anybody wanted to have a special session.
Right. Well, the few people that said, well, I'm hearing, and you know,
yeah,
now,
to be fair,
there were a few people that were saying, well, I'm hearing, you know, I'm hearing rumors that they want to do redistricting, right, that their kid's coming from DC. And we kind of went, oh,
okay.
But, you know, it turned out that it is a priority of Donald Trump and the people around him, and it's been pressed. So let's, you know, let's step back. So what do we have? So we have the special session proclamation in which, you know, we now have, you know, the flood mitigation. So what is, just stepping in very general terms, is we're going to want to talk about the politics of the agenda, because we're going to have to talk about agenda management.
Right, yeah.
In the session. So what do we have? We have four items that are related to flood disaster relief,
right,
and funding and evaluating preparedness. So, you know, a bucket of flooding and disaster items. You've got, you know, bringing back legislation to eliminate the STAR test, which didn't make it last session, was, you know, discussed, but didn't get through.
Yeah.
You've got a kind of general invitation to reduce property tax burden on Texans, but also more specifically to impose spending limits on entities authorized to impose property taxes. Now that's in
line with his emergency item, to be fair.
No, that's still, you know, that's,
I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, well,
that's something that, you know, when you're putting a gen together, you're Greg Abbott, and you're thinking about what you want, what you've asked for already, what they haven't delivered, and the fact that you're running next year, having property taxes on the call. You've already done a pretty big property tax relief bill, but, you know.
Well, and just to hop on the polling for 1 second here. And when we ask people what they expect about their property taxes in the June poll after they pass the most recent reduction, it's still the case that more people expect their property taxes to go up in the future than expect them to go down. And in fact, the share who expect them to go up is higher than at the end of the last session when we asked the question again. So,
you know, which kind of folds back onto the discussion we were having a few minutes ago about, you know, just the general sense of low expectations and low levels of faith in the political class.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately for them, that includes the Texas legislature.
Right.
Okay. So then two items on hemp, which everybody listening to this issue that came up as, you know, adopted by the lieutenant governor as a big issue. He really wants to abolish access to these products writ large, rammed a bill through on this, I think a little bit surprisingly through the House side.
Yeah.
To a lot of people, and then the governor vetoed it.
Yeah.
After a lot of consideration, it was kind of the, for all intents and purposes, based on what we know, it was the thing that he was hanging on to, and that led to, you know, the late night vetoes on the day 20 of the veto period, the last day. So we got those out there, big things, and we'll obviously come back to that. A very general invitation to legislate on abortion.
Yep.
Language of the, you know, the language of the proclamation worth looking at. Legislation further protecting unborn children and their mothers from the harm of abortion. Now, just to be as concrete as possible about that, you compare the generality of that, the broad scope of that, to the one above it on hemp, legislation to comprehensively regulate hemp-derived products, including limiting potency, restricting synthetically modified compounds, and establishing enforcement mechanisms, all without banning a lawful agricultural commodity. So, you know, two very different approaches to these two problems. You've got the evergreen among, you know, conservative social media-enabled Republicans on quote-unquote taxpayer-funded lobbying. Then you've got four items that are revisiting issues that he vetoed, and I'm not going to go into the specifics of those, but that's bringing back things, and the veto messages on these items had pretty specific guidance.
Yeah.
Then you've got an item on proposing a constitutional amendment that would allow the Attorney General, still in the news very much, to prosecute state election crime. So speaking to election dynamics, quote-unquote voter fraud, also a favorite with Republican primary audience. And then, you know, kind of ninth or something on this list.
Tucked in, you could say.
I honestly have to admit, and people that, you know, on my social media account, you know, I'm on the record, I kind of missed it in the first pass because it was so buried. I thought, oh, he's going to add it later. I had to go back and delete the tweet and redo it. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it was fun for me because I don't get those very often, right? You go, oh, it's in there.
Right.
So.
And, you know, so, and then, so congressional redistricting. Right. So that's where we are for now. And so, you know, I think what this does is introduce, given this menu,
yeah,
and given the context, what does the agenda look like? And I think, you know, there are a lot of factors to take into consideration here, right?
Yeah.
There's the, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, flood and disaster response. And, you know, I think we've kind of set some of the politics of that out there,
yeah,
and the fact that, you know, there are questions about public attention to that and how long that will last, what it looks like in the context of a legislature that people don't have a lot of faith in anyway and don't pay a lot of attention to anyway. But we'll come back to that because I, you know, I don't want to assume facts that are not yet in evidence. But on redistricting,
mm-hmm,
you know, redistricting really structurally changes or has a big structural effect on how this is going to unfold, because already, and it's cooled off a little today, mm-hmm, but, you know, I think you probably did one or two. I did a couple of media hits yesterday on, and you know, or answered, actually some of it was just answering questions,
yeah,
from political friends from out of state going, okay, so what about this redistricting thing? Are the Democrats going to break quorum?
Right.
You know, how serious is this? Can they? And I think, you know, the quorum break reflex here,
yeah,
you know, which is put in the context by a lot of people of, well, you know, Democratic voters are pissed off that Democrats aren't doing enough to push back against, mm-hmm, you know, Republican perfidy and all this, yeah, kind of stuff. But, you know, the drama of the quorum break, you know, which we've seen fairly recently, 2021,
yeah,
and then, you know, the historic back in the 2000s, you know, those have generally not turned out very well for the Democrats.
Well, and you know, you started this by saying, you know, okay, so like, here's this agenda now, you know, what do we think about it? I think these things relate, which is when I look at this whole agenda, and I, you know, I think you could quibble here, but when I say, what do they have to do?
Yeah.
What do they have to come
up with? So we started this offline, and I started the panel with this yesterday, so I'm curious, what do you think?
Yeah, I think they have to respond to the flood because that's just basic politics. They've, you know, it's happened, it's on people's minds. They've said they're
going to— have to, meaning, we mean, if they don't do it, the governor will call them back.
Yeah. And I mean, and the thing is, and I also just think it's, I mean, I even mean it in a more colloquial sense, which is like, they're going to do it because it's like, because they're going to have the votes from both Democrats and Republicans to get something done here.
Yeah.
And there's a desire to act. The other thing I think they have to get done because of the politics of this is redistricting. And I don't have a much longer list than that, to be quite honest. I don't even think, I mean, like the hemp thing, I think if they get something done that meets the governor's, you know, very specific instructions, I think he'd be happy to sign it. If they can't do it in the time window with everything else going on and we just keep the status quo until the next session, I kind of think he'd be fine with that too.
Yeah.
And so,
well, that raises the question then of,
right,
would the lieutenant governor let that happen?
Well, you know, I think
if, so, you know, if it's in his power.
So let me ask a question to you. Let me turn, yeah, it back to you in this way, because the way that we were talking about this before, and you had set this up, is that because of the flooding, the idea of a Democratic quorum break, setting aside even if the flooding didn't happen, but now given the flooding, it really changes the calculus for Democrats because, and I'm just going to say this because, you know, because of the way that they're going to end up sequencing this stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's very unlikely. Let me just put it this way. There is a 0% chance that they come in and they say, let's deal with all this flood mitigation stuff right now. And then we'll deal with all this really hot political stuff after we've dealt with this. Because then, yeah, okay, the Democrats could, right, do this and leave. That's not going to happen. It'd be political malpractice. In fact, we've seen various instances of this kind of dynamic play,
yeah,
out. People are very aware of the sequencing.
Yeah, no, and certainly in the building.
Yeah, yeah, that's what, right? I mean.
I mean,
when I talk about people, not normal people.
But. I mean, this is one of the things that's very interesting, right? Is, you know, and I can't remember, I think somebody, I can't remember if this came up in the panel yesterday and me talking to people about it afterwards, is that, you know, this all puts Dust, I think Gromer Jeffers brought this up yesterday. This Dustin Burrows in a very interesting position.
It does.
You know, he's come out of that session, you know, one of the big storylines at the end of the regular session was, hey, Dustin Burrows, look at it.
Yeah.
You know, he managed to do this. And yeah, you know, on the panel yesterday, one of my panelists who I won't name, Harvey Crumper,
yeah,
you know, kind of talking about the degree to which, you know, the rap on Burroughs, and to be fair to Harvey, he didn't articulate this as his position, but that the rap on Burroughs among a lot of people per Harvey is that, you know, the way he accomplished that was by just doing what the lieutenant governor wanted.
you know, I have to think. I mean, I think that that, you know, like just
that's fair. That's fair enough.
It sounds fair enough. And that's right. That is fair enough. So anyway, the point being, though, just to go back, it's like, okay, so the Democrats probably aren't in a position, given the introduction of the flood relief and response, to just disappear because they're going to be raked over the coals for it.
Yeah, no, that, you know, it would be political malpractice for the Republicans to move that first and give them the opportunity to do that. But I do kind of think it would be political malpractice for the Democrats to follow up on your scenario to say, oh, you know, everybody understands that redistricting is a fundamental issue of fairness to our base, to justice, to democracy, and we got to go.
No. And that's crazy because most people have like no idea what redistricting is. So we start there, but then the flip side is the question that you were kind of pushing into, which I'll push back to you, which is like, okay, so if the Democrats are constrained now in this way, and this, you brought up Burroughs too, which I think is an interesting thing just to think about how he enters into this. You know, what are Patrick's, you know, what are sort of the red lines for Patrick on this with respect to THC and hemp, given this sequencing, given this constellation of issues, given, you know, the pressure of the president to get something done on redistricting?
Yeah,
the floods. I mean, all of a sudden, it just feels like the hemp thing, which like everybody was so focused on until redistricting came along, it just doesn't feel like it.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, look, that hemp bill, I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the Senate comes up with for the hemp bill.
Yeah, I mean—
Given the call.
Right, and to your— Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess they can't just do what they did.
Right.
So,
yeah, I mean—
They can't just pass the same bill, which is kind of—
I don't think so.
That is Patrick's normal kind of MO. Yeah. If you just pass the same bill and say, we passed this bill, it's good. You know, you pass it and let's go.
And either the House, you know, it's the House's fault that nothing got sent to the governor, or the House goes along and sends it to the governor, and then he vetoes it again and says that violates the call. What's wrong with you guys?
And you know—
But I believe, actually, it wouldn't, you know, actually, I'm not— stopping to think carefully enough, that can't happen, because what will happen is if they send that bill to the House and it was to make it to the floor, it will just get called a
point of order.
It'll be, you know, there'll be a point of order on it. It's not consistent with the call.
So. Right. So yeah, I mean, I think that's—
I'm gonna cool my jets on racing through these scenarios.
But I guess the point being, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, just to the same extent that like Democrats can't just do whatever they want because of the insertion of this natural disaster and the horrible consequences of it, I think Patrick is also probably likely a little bit more constrained than he would have been for the same reasons, right? I mean, he's got the same considerations on his
mind. I mean, it's one thing to hold, you know, whatever, the budget or a property tax bill or, you know, to hold, you know, X bill hostage because you want to get
Y
vouchers.
Yeah.
Right. Whole other thing to say, look, we got to ban marijuana and we're not moving anything until we do that.
Yeah.
Or ban THC hemp products. We're not moving anything. People go, so you're not willing to move flood relief.
Right.
And disaster relief.
But also.
And you're going to tell, you know, the big daddy in Washington, D.C., that his redistricting is going to have to wait.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got a bone to pick with Governor Abbott about THC products. I just think the politics of that are not great.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the politics, I mean, the train has left the station. And I said this to you before, but like, I mean, there's a lot about this call that reminds me a lot of 2017, right? And like now it's like, I kind of go, oh, that was like a little while ago. I've been here long enough that it's like, oh, it's been a bit.
Yeah.
But right, Patrick goes, he's not happy because the House, spiked the bathroom bill at that point in time.
Right.
Then he spikes some regulations, sunset bills. We've got
it's the high point of conflict between Patrick and Strauss.
Right. And then all of a sudden,
and the dysfunction between Strauss, Patrick, and Abbott.
Yeah. And jokingly, it's like that's when everybody was a plumber for a minute, right? But also, like the American Medical, like, or the Medical Association.
I just want to say I wasn't a plumber.
No, you were. Everybody was a plumber. But then there was also like doctors and there's other things that were really important. So he forced the special session. And the thought was, you know, and we had this discussion at the time. I mean, everyone was kind of like, well, what's Abbott going to do? Is he going to just call back like just the sunset bills? Is he going to do the bathroom bill? Because the businesses were against the bathroom bill. And Abbott, none of that. He came back with a 20-item special session list that had almost every political issue that could matter to a Republican primary voter. They got through, I believe, a little more than half, I think, when all was. I think it was like 12 of the 20 is like the number in my mind, but, you know, someone can check. And then I remember after that, Patrick, you know, Abbott came out and said, and Patrick came out after that and said, you know, the House really messed this up. And Abbott came out and said, look at all that I did.
Yeah.
I was able to pass all, I was able to get these 12 additional things passed. And, you know, on these other things, well, you know, sometimes the legislature is capable of doing it and, you know, sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not calling them back. Small government state. We've got what we want. Let's move on. And I look at this list and I feel, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of discussion going on about how, you know, thinking about Abbott's last run for governor and sort of the unpleasantness of having to run against, you know, multiple kind of well-funded people and sort of the implications of that.
Oh, in the primary.
In the primary. And so the idea is, you know, a lot of people were sort of pointing out this time, like, he really doesn't want to have a bunch of primary challengers this time. And boy, does it seem unlikely it's going to happen. And part of that is, you know, you've got $80 million in the bank, but also whether or not they do 90% of this, and setting aside the things that we think they need to do, redistricting and water and the flood stuff, it's like, yeah, you know, I tried to get them to eliminate the STAR test. Yeah, I couldn't do it. You know, yeah, I tried. You know what?
I gave them an invitation to send me more, a ban on mifepristone, and they didn't get their act
together. Tried to get them to decrease your property taxes even more because I think you're being burdened, but they couldn't do it. And so he's in the catbird seat at this point.
Right.
No matter what. And so it really—
To the extent that if he even gets called on the carpet for that, right? I mean—
Yeah, which again, I mean, well, that's the point. It doesn't even matter. That's the point. It's the insulation of it. And he's never going to be called to the carpet on it. So that's exactly the point of doing it. But I mean, it sort of speaks.
Though I will still go back and say, but all things being equal.
Yeah.
And this is what I thought you were going to raise. I mean, the hypothetical I was posing when we were in the office before coming up
here to record
was, imagine a universe, if you can, where Trump is not pressuring them on redistricting, but everything else is the same.
Yeah.
Now, that's problematic, as I was saying, because, you know, Abbott's veto decisions may or may not, I would be surprised if they were not at least,
right,
because he's a pro, took into account the fact that they knew the pressure was coming, already being exerted for the redistricting session. But just for sake of argument, say there's no redistricting on the agenda and they're not under pressure to call a session for that. Does he call a special session for the pot bill after Lieutenant Governor pitched a fit about it? Or then, you know, a week later, or a couple weeks later, does he then call a special session for flood relief and emergency relief? And I it's hard for me to not imagine that what he would have done was said, yeah, I vetoed that bill, but, you know, I'm going to have HHS put together we're going to investigate and increase enforcement on these THC dealers. Lieutenant Governor's right. This is being run loosely, but we don't have to oversteer because their business is just a modification of the position he's taken.
Yeah.
And on the flood mitigation, you know, he declares an emergency and he finds ways to dip into the pots of money and the resources they already have to deal with it. And he's the guy that's dealing with it.
Yeah.
And what's the legislature going to do?
Hold interim hearings.
Yeah.
Just to say real quick, like,
Why not? Not even a terrible response,
you know, I mean, really. Yeah. But I mean, I think to your point—
I'm not even sure now what the point of that
exercise is. No, can I pick it up?
But I think the point is that it does—
No, I want to pick it up because you asked me before about this, and the question was basically, and I was having a hard time because there are a lot of counterfactual elements to this, and there's a lot of things you have to call constant, but the idea is, okay—
You're a nonfiction guy.
I'm very much a nonfiction guy. It's true. But the question becomes, you know, absent the push for redistricting, do we see a special session, even with the flooding, even with the THC veto? And at first I was like, well, yeah. And then in the 25 minutes, 30 minutes since we had that conversation, I'm like, you know, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And it's more of a gut feeling because obviously there's so much pieces to this, but you think about, again, the disasters we've had in the past. I mean, the thing about the winter storm was we were in session. So it wasn't like, you know, they had to call them in for a special.
They didn't have a choice.
Uvalde, they did not call them in. And also, just to make a point, after Uvalde, the thing they did in the first session after that, I believe, was pass constitutional carry. So, like, what the nature of the response looks like is a its own thing. But I think to your point, absent the call for a redistricting, which requires the special session and requires it now because of the nature of the calendar— I don't know if they're here right now.
Yeah.
I mean, look,
I think the one argument—
Can I just—
go ahead.
And part of it is what I said before. Like, I don't think this— I'm looking at the proclamation.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, I obviously don't think the goal is to pass something for all these, because it's almost impossible if you watch the legislature to think that they're really going to get through all this stuff. But some of it's clearly not, like, just not happening. Like, legislation proposing a constitutional amendment allowing the attorney general to prosecute state election crimes. How many Democratic votes do you think you get on that? How about none? That is not a real item.
Yeah. That's not going
to
happen.
But that's the thing, though. But it's on there because you get to say
you
did it.
Well, you know, look, I would say that even more so about the abortion item.
Sure.
You know, you look at our numbers on abortion.
Right.
And, you know, we're a broken record on the podcast about just how divided Republican public opinion is on that. you know, do you really want to open this up? I mean, maybe it's okay-ish for a Republican primary, but do you want to go into the general election with that being something you just did? Now, look, they could go and do it, and, you know, he'd have to sign it.
Yeah.
So, but I think you're right. I mean, I think not only are there things that he doesn't necessarily expect that they'll do anything, he just wants the credit for raising them. I think there's some things on here he actively doesn't want them to do.
Right. But he can say, hey, I tried.
Yeah. So, you know, which is, you know, part of being, you know, politically skilled.
Yeah. And I think that's the overall point here. I mean, for me, it's like, you know, you've watched Abbott over time do this stuff and it's like, okay, he's taking control of this process now. You know, he's taking it from Patrick. And by the way, you know, in this little interim period, while he's kind of been thinking about it, he's raised $20 million because that's also like what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of things they like to put on a special session agenda. And so if you say, you know, I'm probably going to make a special session agenda, it's really a pretty open invitation for people to make their pitches.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you said, I think you see that in the numbers, and that's just another indication of, again, I think how good he is at using the office.
Now, I would add two things to that to get us close to the end here. You know, first, you know, back on the agenda thing for a beat, I want to give the idea that the THC hemp thing could kind of reemerge a fair enough shot.
Yeah.
And that's also by, and I want to do that in part by pointing out that, look, there is, you know, we've been, you know, I've been a little dismissive, I think, in referring to the way the governor, lieutenant governor has gone after this, and I'm okay with that. But to be fair, you know, there is, you know, there is some political exposure here from Abbott, for Abbott if they do nothing. I don't think it's a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, the lieutenant governor has established this as an issue from his perspective that is about protecting kids,
yeah,
public health, et cetera. So there's a little bit of exposure to just saying, hey, this will be fine till next time. And look, the governor's very careful.
Yeah.
Part of what you're just describing is his caution and his strategic thinking and his ability to like foresee hazards and go out of his way to avoid them,
yeah,
or, you know,
very loyally
address the, you know, address the exposure, address the risk and get in front of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's possible the THC thing, you know, might have driven a little bit more. And I also want to say it's also possible then that, again, depending on what, how these things unfold, what kind of opportunities on, you know, the lieutenant governor's part, no political slouch himself,
no,
what he sees as an opening to both get what he wants on this and put pressure on the governor.
Yeah, I mean,
and the speaker for that.
No, and yeah, I think that's fair. And I think there's sort of two, I sort of have two, you know, I agree and I'll sort of push back. My agreement would be to say, you know, the thing about Patrick is, you know, say what you want about him, like him, hate him, whatever. I think he's committed to some of the things he's committed to. I mean, he's demonstrated that. He's demonstrated that with vouchers.
And this is one of the things he seems committed
well,
to.
Well, you know, say, well, look, and for people like us who've been around for a long time, right? Ish. I mean, not Harvey long time, but like in the sense that we've heard things multiple times, it's like, you know, we know that Patrick has been pushing for vouchers for a very, very long time. He's ideologically committed to vouchers. And what we saw was he would take any voucher bill. He put something in the House, they put it back. He said, great. We've heard for a long time that Patrick does not like the general expansion of THC access at all.
Right.
This is something
hemp or otherwise.
Yeah, hemp or otherwise. And this is something that he's been committed to. I mean, I think I've heard, you know, I've heard statements, you've heard statements where he says, yeah, I know what the public opinion is. I don't care. He's even said it really in the public now,
yeah,
that he doesn't really care what the public opinion is. This, he feels that he's right on this issue. So I think that is like, we just have to acknowledge that that's there. We don't want to just like dismiss that. At the same time, I guess what I would say to push back on is like, okay, but like, is the lieutenant, if the thing just, the status quo remains, this bill doesn't get passed, when we move on, you know, what is the likelihood that the lieutenant governor continues on with the rhetoric that clearly the governor wants to create legal marijuana in the state? Like, is he really going to, yeah, keep pushing this through the Republican? Like,
yeah,
I don't think so.
I don't either.
And so I think that, you know, the credibility of the threat here is pretty limited. And so I,
right,
think, you know, I think everybody probably knows,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably, I suspect that, well, the governor's people have taken, have,
yeah, right,
you know, factored that. And I'm probably pulled in detail on it, I suspect. You know, but that's why I think the bigger caution that I would think he might consider, and mm-hmm, I don't, you know, again, part of it is just in this counterfactual scenario. So I've already spent too much time on it than I should have probably. But the other thing is that there's another risk separate from just the political risk of Dan Patrick trash talking him and encouraging opposition that, you know, if something happens, a bad batch of gummies kills some people or
some, you know, some kids,
some kids wind up getting into some gummies. They, you know, some, you know, whatever, there's a, you know, there's a bad run or whatever that it might be. I think they're probably more worried about that. I mean, I'm not saying they're ignoring, because they never ignore the Lieutenant Governor, but so anyway, so there's that. All right. So let's, the one other thing I was going to raise, and this is just one last bit of speculation, is that though I've never heard, I haven't had the chance to talk to somebody and ask them, okay, well, game that out for me, why you think this. But I think there's a kind of a general sense, or there's, I shouldn't say general, there's a very common sense out there that they're not, whatever they do, whatever comes out of this or doesn't come out of this, it's not going to be just one session.
Mm.
You know, I feel a lot of people going, there's no way they're going to grapple with all this in one session. Now, whether that's 60 days or 30 in another 4 or 5, but that also is kind of into this whole, like, it gets us back to how the Democrats game this out. Because look, this came up in the panel yesterday, but I think it's pretty obvious that this goes back to why agenda management is so and sequencing in particular is so important here. Because if whatever happens, if, you know, Patrick and Burroughs somehow can't agree on how they're going to do this, or the governor somehow disrupts this, or the Democrats come up with a way short of breaking quorum to chub and to delay and, you know, to slow things down, which they did do reasonably effectively, I mean, within the universe of possibility in the last session. And redistricting doesn't get to the floor till closer to the end. Well, the price, literal and political, that Democrats pay for breaking quorum decreases as the session unfolds.
Yeah.
So if the sequencing works out in a way that the Democrats can bolt for a few days. Now remember, and I'm sure you've seen this, the other thing to remember here is that the House rules anticipated just this moment in that, or at least some approximation of it, in that the House rules now have a $500 a day fine on members if for every day that they are not in attendance. And that doesn't come out of your camp, can't come out of campaign funds, can't come out of your office budget, comes out of your pocket.
Right.
Now, panel yesterday, Harvey Kronberg was arguing that there are people willing to cover those costs.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, probably right.
That carries its own advantages and disadvantages.
Right. You know, so Soros paid you guys to leave.
Right. I mean, Abbott's got $80 million and we're talking about the people paying $500 a day for, you know.
Yeah,
for,
right.
You know.
So, I mean, I don't want to say that will, you know, that in itself, you know, I kind of respect what the point Harvey is making is that, you know.
Yeah.
There are probably people that are willing to help defray those costs, but, you know, it's not nothing. So anyway, all of that is just a way of saying, I think, you know, that I think that may be one of the reasons that so many people think, look, this is not going to get resolved one way or the other in one session, because there's going to be a lot of, you know, tactical sidestepping by the Democrats to, you know, to try to avoid this redistricting with the support and the pressure from both national Democratic elites. You know, they're up there meeting with Hakeem Jeffries and all this. And also this, you know, this amorphous sense that, well, I think my voters want me to do this, whether they do or not, or my, you know, I think it's more likely my voters want me to do something, and this is the something that I think I should be doing to demonstrate them that I have that commitment. And I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
you've got to get a lot of Democrats to do it. I mean.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, and this is all really central to the discussion that we're having about all this other stuff, which is like, that all depends on what, you know. Not just what you think, but what turn out to be the actual priorities of the people who are making these decisions.
Right.
And that's not something we're going to know. And I think, Jeremy, like, you know, I mean, guys, we'll come back to this, which is like, if Abbott really just needs flood mitigation and redistricting, and he can get them within 30 days, and I think, again, and a bunch of this other stuff falls by the wayside, I think he would be fine. And I actually think to some extent, you know, I mean, I mean, something that I've been sort of tracking with or thinking about in terms of our polling and everything else is, you know, Democrats in the most recent poll, there's sort of an interesting shift in opinion. I'm just going to flag it because I think it's useful. And, you know, and we've talked to this many, many times, but, you know, generally speaking, when we ask people what's the most important issue facing the state, about, you know, 50 to 60% of Republicans, although it's been going down since Trump took office, will say immigration or the border. For Democrats, it takes about six or seven issues to get to 60 to 70%. You're talking about education, healthcare, climate, gun control, political corruption, leadership. Well, all of a sudden in the last poll, about 30 to 40% of Democrats, both when asked about the most important problem facing the state and the country, pointed to political corruption and leadership. And I do wonder for Abbott as he gets closer and closer to Trump, you know, when we talked a lot about this, how Trump inserted himself during the legislative session very, very publicly, to the extent that Texas is seen, whether, you know, whether this is fair or not, to be doing the bidding of Trump, and Abbott seemed to be reacting to Trump aggressively in such a way that, again, is, you know, speaks to the drawing of the lines and the way the game is being played sort of in the middle of the game, which, you know, we're all adults here. It's fine. It's politics, right? But I think it does draw more attention to Abbott in a way that probably, you know, I don't want to say it doesn't help him outside of his Republican primary electorate.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And, you know, he's beginning to appear, I don't think I'm ready to say risky yet.
Yeah.
But we're beginning to see some tremors in the Trump base over this Epstein thing. Personally, I think it's going to pass.
Yeah.
But I would have thought it passed already, and they're obviously worried about it.
Yeah, and I'd also just say one other thing. You know, we're talking, I remember during the last sort of special session runs during about property taxes and vouchers and all that last session. And, you know, somebody at one point asked me, well, can't Abbott just keep calling the back and again? I go, well, yeah, he has the right to do that, but ultimately you just eventually look ineffective.
Yeah.
And so just to say, you know, in a small government state where they're not supposed to be here all the time, where they're supposed to get their work done, you know, there is like, he can't just keep calling them back. Yeah. Again and again, because at some point he just looks like he can't accomplish
what he says. Also remember, in this case, they also—
There's a deadline.
I mean, it's not right next, you know, the deadline isn't tomorrow, but because the fulcrum here—
Yeah.
You know, to the extent that the fulcrum here is redistricting, you know, there's a time limit
there. December 8th is the filing deadline.
Yeah, there are filing deadlines. There's going to be court challenges no matter what you do. So the sooner you can get this done, the better, I think.
Well, and I want, and just to hit on a couple of these things. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of questions that, you know, we've sort of gotten about, like, well, how likely is it that they're, and I don't know. I mean, I like to assume, like, there's a lot of sophisticated people who know what they're doing, who are working on this. So I don't think that these numbers are just, like, you know, made up. I'll say this, a couple things, just first as someone who watches this thing and then someone as a data person. As someone who watches this thing, it's notable in redistricting how careful everybody usually is. And when I say careful, I mean careful about what they say.
Yeah.
Careful about how they transfer information, what they put in emails. That is not the process that we're looking at right now.
Well, they're victims of Donald Trump's success at this.
Well, they are, but the state right now, I mean, literally.
I mean, specifically in terms of, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the scenario I think you're referring to is, you know, when the current maps are, you know, being, you know, some parts of the current maps are in court, you know, the redistricting chair in the Senate, you know, you could, you know, give her truth serum and she'd still, I think, say, race wasn't even on my mind.
Right. And then the DOJ this week said, we think you built these districts based on race. Now, they mean a different thing. It's kind of like bail reform. Let's not get into it. But they said, hey, we think you, you know, you used race. And they're like, well, maybe we did.
Yeah, I guess we better. Guys say so.
And the fact is, these public statements matter. The stuff that goes on during these things matter. And you may say, well, yeah, it's not really. But like, look, if this takes a little while and there's going to be a court challenge, which there is definitely going to be a court challenge, and then all of a sudden you've got these contradictory statements about the role that race played in the creation of these maps and the drawing of these districts. Well, I'm going to say, like, that's probably going to be a problem. It's not guaranteed to be a problem.
But it's
probably going to create some kind of problem. So that's just one observation. The other is just to say, again, I assume everybody who's doing this is sophisticated. But I will point out that, like, the data that's available, like, from my perspective, doesn't seem to be super, I don't want to say, directive about this. And I'll just point out this way. And people point this out in the sense, that's not the right word. I'm trying to figure out what the right word is. I'm skeptical. And the reason I'm skeptical is, one.
You're skeptical of what?
Of the ability to generate 3 to 5 seats with a map draw. Like, it's easy. Like, it would just easily happen. Yeah. And part of it is that, you know, you've got census data, which is now pretty old, right? You know, and it seems like a lot of the rationale that's being thrown around that's not cover is, look, we did, you know, we're doing really well in the state, we being Republicans.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you know, we've had gains in some certain parts of the state and these should be reflected in the map. those gains are basically based on 2024. And we talk all the time about how you can't draw a line through 2 points. It's really hard to draw a line through 1 point either, because you can put it in any direction you want. Midterm elections have lower turnout than general elections. Also, the President's Party usually has a tougher time in midterm elections than they do in generals. Yeah. So whatever data that people have available to them, I just don't know how prescriptive it is about how you would make movements to generate the kind of certain outcomes that people are saying. And again, a lot of it's bravado. But the idea that, like, well, we could definitely generate 3 to 5 seats, no problem. I'm kind of like, I'd like to see it. I don't know that that's true.
And I guess, you know, like, I was trying to figure out what we, because I don't disagree with that, but I, something about the way you set that up when you were talking about it before, that I couldn't quite say, yeah, that's right, or I agree.
Yeah.
But I think part of what's going on to me is that there's two different things,
right.
or there's at least two different things. One, can they take these heavily, for all intents and purposes, uncontested Republican states or seats. Republican Senate or House districts, U.S. House districts, and start moving things around and build, you know, we'll just call them what they're building, you know, 4 or 5 Republican opportunity districts.
Yeah, right.
Right. And I think they can. Now, the problem is, what are the trade-offs? And this is what I've been saying kind of from the beginning when this came up, is I think they can do that without too much problem.
Yeah.
But can they do that in a way that doesn't cause exposure elsewhere and put some other shit, which is why, you know, virtually nobody nobody in the Republican delegation in the Texas delegation is coming out publicly and going, no, we shouldn't do that. But everybody's talking off the record about it. And then, you know, you get John Carter the other day saying, I'm fine. Draw me a district. I can win wherever.
Of all the Republicans, like, I don't think he should be saying that, but that's just
that's exactly. And yet there he is.
Right.
Right. So I guess what I think about that is, you know, whether they're using some amalgam of 2024, 2022, whether they're, you know, however smart or not smart or responsible or conscious they're being about the data they're using for the baseline, I think we do, you know, I think we do know enough about just how lopsided some of those districts are.
Yeah.
And that once they're saying we're going to create that many, you know, they're going to try to create that many seats, and they're attacking those seats in Houston and, you know, the districts in the DOJ letter to
Dallas.
The state. I mean, yeah, the fact that it's some around Houston, some around Dallas, and then those South Texas districts that abut into Central Texas, you're moving everything around.
Yeah.
Right? And so that means that, do I think that once they do that, they're guaranteed 4 or 5 seats? I agree with you on that. There's, you know, the data's not sound enough, and there's just, you know, look, it's an election. It's inherently uncertain. We don't know how much 2026 is going to look like 2018.
Right.
Reasonable argument that it's going to look a lot that way. But, you know, been a lot of reasonable arguments for things related to elections involving Donald Trump that we've kind of gone, oh, well, except it didn't. And so, you know, if the outcome is they get new maps that are drawn according to these lines, and they rejigger everything, and they piss everybody off, and they maybe kind of as an opportunity to screw somebody like, say, I don't know, off the top of my head, Chip Roy.
Right.
And they either hold or they knock off Cuellar or Vicente Gonzalez, and maybe they pick up another one of these seats that they diddle with and they get 2 or 3. Everybody, you know, you could be right, but they're still going to be fine.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'd say, like, I still find myself, I mean, even the way that you lay that out, I think we're just sort of, there's a lot of unknowns here. We just have to acknowledge that there's just unknowns. I just, you know, thinking about why the way that they changed the seats and the way that they've changed them between the last round and this round, and sort of the rationale behind that, in the sense that, you know, I think about Austin as a good
By last round, you mean 2010 and 2020?
I'm talking about, the districts.
Or 2011 and 2021.
Yeah, I'm talking about the districts that we had during the last decade and the one they've changed them to now, and sort of the nature of those changes. And one of the things is, you know, Chip Roy used to represent basically the University of Texas, right? And and way, way out west of here.
Yeah.
And they're about—
And he almost lost, and they helped him out.
Yeah, and there were about six representatives who represented the Austin area, all with sort of a finger in Austin, and then all out into wherever. And then they sort of, you know, and again, the election trends that sort of were ongoing were like, boy, that's kind of making a problem for some of these districts. So they decided, you know, sort of against, you know, what everybody said they were going to do for a long time. It was like, well, let's just make an Austin district. Let's just pack all the Democrats.
And do an, you know, basically an incumbent protection plan.
Right. But
that included Democrats.
Well, that's exactly right. And including, so that's the other thing too, which is, you know, I mean, there's sort of two things going on here, which is, you know, one, I would say, there's a couple of different things, but I mean, one, I'd say, it was an incumbent protection plan, which means those Democratic districts aren't 52-48 districts in most cases. They're also like 60-40 districts in a lot of cases. Yeah. So when you've got a 60-40 district next to a 60-40 district, yeah, you can move voters around. But also, this is part of political geography too. The voters who are the most movable, because they have to be adjacent to the district, are also probably the least politically homogenous. So like, you know, in the sense of like, you're not going to get a bunch of conservatives.
In the urban districts.
In the urban districts, which are really what you're talking about in that area. Yeah, now look, you can mess around in South Texas for sure. And those three seats, you know, you've got the one congressionally, if you want to go after Cuellar, if you want to go after Gonzalez, you can do it. And you're going to do it by grabbing more of those sort of rural voters who are up in between Central Texas and the Valley. But then what that's going to mean is ultimately what? Well, you know, you're piling more Democratic voters into those seats. And that's kind of where they were in 2018. Now, the thing is, this might benefit Trump in this 2-year cycle, but as people point out, like,
let's be clear, that's all he cares
about. That's all he cares about. But that's what's sort of interesting about this is that, you know, yeah, this may net you some version of what you say it might net you. It may not, because the conditions may not support it.
Yeah.
And then also, you may just be creating less safe seats for yourself going
forward.
Well,
look, I think they are. And I think because he doesn't have to bear the cost, I don't think Trump and the people around him care.
Yeah.
I think they think if they can just push through this next cycle.
Yeah.
You know what they're, you know, I mean, you can almost see what the conversations were like. You know, they bring the map jars to DC and they go, hey, why didn't, you know, you should just make, you know, Chip Roy can work harder or whoever, you know, well, Chip Roy is not a good example because they would say that first.
Yeah.
But, you know, just make your guys work harder.
Do you know what I don't know? And I mean,
that's what I think.
We're kind of getting near the end of this, but I'll throw this out there. Maybe someone can email me, but I'm going to look into it because I would like to know. You know, ultimately when you redistrict, you need to maintain some kind of, equal representation of the district. You have similar numbers of voters. So I wonder at a mid-decade districting, what data do they rely on to guarantee that? Cause I mean, to your point, you can say like, why don't you just move these guys here? Why don't you just move these guys here? And it's like, and I think that's exactly like what some people are kind of approach this with sophistication. I want to be clear. Yeah. Like they've got models, they've got maps, they've got GIS, they're working this stuff, but also, what is the data? Because I mean, at the end of the day, there might be, you might kind of redo these searches. Like, are these all one person, one vote? You know, you say, you know, what kind of rate, you know, are you dismantling opportunity districts? Like what is happening here?
You know, I think that bar is obviously so much lower now.
Right. But I just wonder what the data is.
You know,
I just
don't have that, you know,
yeah,
I've looked at those spreadsheets and I don't remember, you know, I think because it's not voters, it's population that they just use the most recent census data.
Well, that's going to be problematic because those are all estimates.
Yeah, but I mean, what they have.
Yeah, I guess.
But I think that's what they use.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, but if that's what, I see your skepticism, but I mean, if that's what they use, that's what they, have.
Well, no, I said, I'm starting with a question. I don't know what they use in this space. It just seems to me that like, because the courts are actually very specific about the level of deviation, there's specific deviation that you can have between the size of districts. And it depends on what the district
I understand
is.
All that, but I do think the baseline data
not for you.
I'm
doing it for the audience. I know you know, but what I'm saying is if it's already the case that there's a smaller baseline deviation at the congressional level than as you go down. So you already have an expectation of a small deviation between the size of those districts. And then you've got an estimate of the number of people in those districts, which also has, you know, a bunch of variants associated with it. And so I just wonder, you know, going to this court thing, there's lots of different ways that this could be challenged. But one of them is just like, hey, do these districts even like meet the basic standards of one person, one vote? If you just start messing with people mid-decade in a way that's not like a little change, but as you point out, probably messes with all the districts in some way or short form. I don't know. I'm sure someone's out there with some more information.
Yeah, I don't think once you've accepted what the data is, even if the data, you know, as we well know, people use estimates all the time.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
I mean, who am I thinking? Oh, wait.
Oh, no. Uh-oh. Is it time to end?
Okay, on that. All right. Good chat. Monday. All happens Monday. legislature back in town. We will probably, I'm going to put a pin in, we probably will not have a podcast next week, but be back the week after unless, you know, something changes and I get a guest or something, because Josh will not be entirely available.
I'm allowed.
So with that, thanks for being here, Josh. As always, excellent technical support from the audio studio here in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to you for listening. As always, the data referenced in the podcast, not a ton today, but some, but all of our polling data, lots of other stuff available at the Texas Politics Project website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So be well, and we'll talk to you on the next Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.